Welcome to Brains Matter, the podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, just an ordinary guy. Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 95 of Brains Matter. Today I've got the final part of the three-part interview with Dr. Andrew Prentice from Monash University. If you haven't listened to episode 93 and 94 yet, I suggest you go back and listen to those ones first. Speaking of the first couple of parts of the interview, I had a bit of feedback about that. David J. Bernstein wrote and said, "I just heard part one of the Dr. Prentice interview. I love listening to people enthusiastic about their research." And Dave the Happy Singer from Sydney wrote in and said, "This guy's so enthusiastic. A total delight of an episode to listen to. I have no idea if he's right, but I love the show." Well, thanks for your feedback, Dave and Dave. And to keep you happy, here is part three of the interview. A couple more questions about Saturn. Do we know where Titan came from? If you mentioned it was an interloper, do we know where it's come from?
That's a very important question. I think Titan formed as a secondary planetary embryo in the same orbit of Saturn. You might recall earlier we had the Saturn as a maybe once had a core of about 15 Earth masses of that was a pod, and then it captured its atmosphere of that 1,000 Earth masses. It probably only captured a tenth, and that say or 80 Earth masses then was captured by the 15 Earth mass core. The planet today weighs 95 Earth masses, so that great pod. The way that great rocky core formed, because in the beginning, Saturn itself, it was spread around its orbit. It was a gas ring there, mostly hydrogen and helium. The gas cooled down, and tiny little grains settle out of the gas to form a concentrated stream. There were these little grains settle out of the gas, as you can see in this schematic here, to form a slurry on the mean orbit of the gas ring. And when this sort of concentrated stream of solids became sufficiently concentrated, although these grains themselves are very small, once you got a great slurry of them there, they could start to feel their own self-gravity, and then they start to clump together around the orbit. And I had another PhD student, Kerry Hurigan, who showed you'd more or less get this clumping process occurring early in the piece, and you might even get a runaway, and a whole lot of these things would form, and you'd have another secondary swarm as well. But the process of planetary accretion is very efficient, and most of it would congeal to form a single planet. But it is possible, as Kerry showed, you might have an isolated embryo, and Titan weighs about a 10,000th of the mass of Saturn, and so about a 1,000th of the mass of this rocky core. And so it is possible Titan tried to form its own planetary center to capture gas, but it wasn't fast enough, and the main planetary core formed, from which Saturn then, once that happened, captured its atmosphere and left Titan stranded and feeling a bit miffed around the orbit. And eventually, after years and years of orbit, Saturn would have become aware that there was this sort of imposter on the same orbit, and a failed sort of giant planet, and it would have caught up with it. Now, Titan at that stage was so big that it could have easily, if Saturn had attracted to it, the great atmosphere of Saturn was a huge thing and very, very light. Saturn would have just swept through that atmosphere and not been worried about it. And it just could have happened a few times, but eventually Saturn would have contracted inwards. And eventually, when Saturn formed its moons, then it would have been a different story. And I think when Titan, on one of its close flirtations with Saturn, didn't realize it was heading straight towards a huge moon, like a companion of Rhea. Rhea has a radius of 765, you know, that's 1,300 kilometers across. It's a huge distance. Titan, during its flirtative pass of Saturn, not looking where it was going and making a rather rude gesture, Saturn ran head on into this moon of which Hyperion is a remnant. So Titan was actually captured. It formed in the same orbit as Saturn, and I've actually used my theory to predict it was made of 50% rock and 50% water ice. Titan ran into one of these moons, which slowed it down, and then it went into a very long very eccentric orbit, but captured orbit around Saturn. Mm-hmm. And even today, Titan still has an eccentricity in its orbit. It's about 3%, and people are intrigued where that came from. But in the beginning, it fits in with my theory. In fact, the eccentricity was much bigger. Mm-hmm. Titan's eccentricity has slowly been eroded, and eventually the Moon will adopt a circular orbit. So I think that Titan is an interloper. All of the physical characteristics of it point towards it. They still haven't measured how much rock inside there is and how much ice, because it's very complicated, and they've got to make a number of gravitational passes to emit. But I have worked out what the internal structure should be as well, mm-hmm. and that's going to be tested over the next little while. And that's something. It's a complex beast, Titan. Its gravitational field has a primary gravitational field due to its nearly spherical shape, but it also has what I call mass anomalies on its mantle, which I had predicted. The rough estimate I had of the moment of inertia of it was about 0.317. It does seem to fall short of their current best estimate, but the current best estimate hasn't been confused by that they haven't been able to resolve these gravitational anomalies, so that has to be properly ironed out.
Okay, and the second question I had about Saturn was the rings. How do they fit in with the...
The rings are very intriguing. Well, there was Cassini, and I think who's noticed that, and of course many observers have looked at the rings of Saturn. They're very reflective. They're so bright. They're really pure water ice. And if my theory was right, and the rings had formed from a former moon of Saturn, you'd expect, as you got that close to Saturn, you'd expect to see a lot of rock. So why aren't the rings? Why don't they have a lot of rock inside them? And that's always been a worry for me. And in fact, I think I did predict there'd be a ring of Saturn called the F ring, which would be made of rock particles. But that's not quite true. I mean, that's a prediction that did become unstuck. I did correctly predict the position of the ring, but it is made of ice, not rock. And that's been a really big challenge. And what I discovered was, as I mentioned earlier, the outer moons of Saturn have densities that fit in with this idea that they gradually increase as you go towards a planet. Mm-hmm. But then you come inwards from the orbit of Dione, and all of a sudden the density of Dione is something like 1.48 or 1.5. You come inwards to Tethys, and instead of the density going up, it actually goes down, and the density of Tethys is only about one, just times about the same as that of water. And this shouldn't happen according to my theory. So, and then if you go to Enceladus, it's also, I think the next moon is, actually Enceladus, suddenly its density goes up again to 1.6. So there's somehow a dip in the densities that cannot be explained by my theory in its original state. And so what I realized was that as this great cloud of Saturn contracted onto this pod, eventually the stage would be reached. We have 80 Earth masses of gas crimping down on this central core of rock and ice. It's going to get so hot that much of the ice from the interior of the planet may be evicted. And about 3 years ago, I published my theory for Rhea. I pointed out that when the Saturn cloud had contracted inside the orbit of Dione, maybe the interior, the core of Saturn had liberated a lot of water vapor, and a lot of water had come out and drenched the atmosphere. And the reason why the inner moons, and particularly the rings, are so icy is that you had all this additional water was evicted from the interior of Saturn. And in fact, that would explain why Tethys' density drops, you know, down to 1. But of course, then the densities increase again up to 1.6. But that fits in with the fact that the temperature now starts to rise up again. And it's all very well to make these crazy ideas, but I made the prediction that Enceladus formed it. Such a high temperature in such a steamy environment, it actually formed as a watery moon. It has a core of rock, and then it has a radius, a great ocean of water around it. The whole moon has only a radius of about 250 kilometers, but there would have been a rocky core of about 170 and a great watery ocean, and I would have called it like a rain moon. And it literally formed a rock, and then a lot of water that rained out onto that to form a mantle. And sure enough, Enceladus has got a pure a pure ice mantle. It's just pure water ice. And this can only be explained in this way. If it once was actually a moon that had an ocean that gradually froze, and that fits in well. And then you come into Mimas, it's actually the whole Saturn's cooling down then, and it would, although Mimas started out as an ocean moon, it also is pure ice and it would have frozen.
Hello, this is Dr. Rachie from the Skeptic Zone, and you're listening to the Brains Matter podcast.
But then you come inwards again, and you'd expect to see smaller bodies that didn't enjoy the ability to form oceans, rocky objects. And of course, Saturn's rings aren't rocky; they're made of ice. So what I propose with the innermost moons of Saturn, interior to the orbit of Mimas, Pandora, Epimetheus, Prometheus, all these inner moons, they're only about 100 kilometers across. They did form as rain moons with little rocky cores, and then they froze, and they're all close to each other, and then over the great eons of time that have elapsed since Saturn formed, and due to the chaotic motions of Titan, these inner moons would have been struck one another, and they do have co-orbital moons and moons that do collide, and therefore the rings of Saturn are a fairly recent formation. The rings of Saturn are shards of pure ice that have come from the mantles of brushing against each other of these tiny inner Pan and all these inner moons that have formed, and then Atlas and Metis, and they've hit one another and brushed against one another, and tiny shards of pure ice have come off, and these tiny shards then will spiral in towards the planet. And that does seem to fit in with the chemistry of the model, but it can only be achieved if you adopt this idea that the innermost moons of Saturn actually had formed in the liquid state. Okay. And that's being tested at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I think the bottom line is the following, that the Saturn system would have liked to have been like a miniature Galileo, or like a Galilean system. Titan, unfortunately, came along and thwarted that plan. It destroyed some moons. And also the moons of Saturn hug that planet much closer than the moons of Jupiter. And Saturn is three times smaller. And those inner gas rings of Saturn, they were still quite cold. As I said, they were able to be cold enough so you could form ice and also closer in water ice. If you look at the same position at Jupiter, and the reason why Jupiter doesn't have icy moons is that everything was so much hotter. Mm-hmm. And you see Io is mostly made of rock and iron. And if you go inwards from the orbit of, I predicted there should be a rocky ring around Jupiter, and that was in fact confirmed, a bit closer than I expected. So Jupiter never was able to enjoy the privilege of ice that Saturn enjoyed. Jupiter was too big and brash, made too much noise, a bit like me. Saturn went about its job a bit more quietly and finished up with a very nice result at the end, a very spectacular ring system. But it has this villain called Titan, still in orbit, who's done so much damage. And even today, the navigation people at JPL say they still have trouble trying to understand the orbits of the Saturn moons. Titan is just introducing so much chaos. Moons aren't exactly where they want them to be when they try to do photographs. They have to slew the cameras. And he's just such a naughty fellow. And years of rehabilitation will probably be required. But I mustn't enter politics now. I'm tempted to thinking back on one of our former prime ministers. But anyway, I think a detention centre would be the correct place for Titan.
We also see ring systems around the other gas giants as well, of some form, like...
Oh, yes, there are huge winds. So it's actually some moving with supersonic speeds, which, endorses my idea that nature has the final say. It's not what one dreams up in an armchair. So you're right, what remains that I haven't yet done, and the last part of our duration of our talk, I've talked about the modern the applications of the theory in understanding the solar system. But at the beginning of our talks, we talked about the supersonic turbulence. No one yet has actually ever seen, they haven't had a telescope yet to actually see cloud going through its formation pangs. And what I'd really like to do is, when they get some of these new airborne telescopes up, Kepler is coming online, I think pretty soon now, maybe this month, that's a new NASA telescope to look for terrestrial worlds around other planets. And the Brits have got one named after, of course, the illustrious Darwin, I think, who's celebrating his 200th year, I think, this year. Mm-hmm. And that'll be launched in a couple of years' time. So I'm hoping that these new telescopes will find evidence for not only for supersonic turbulence, but also young, nascent forming systems, and to evidence that you can see these gas rings. So that would be really important. One nice little bit of triumph for the model that happened last year, there's a poster up behind me showing the new planets of the star HR 8799. And late last year, it was announced that Hubble had spotted three new planets around another star, and they're more or less out of the orbit of Neptune. These cannot be explained by the disk theory. In fact, the standard theory of the solar system, using the American disk theory, says that Uranus and Neptune shouldn't exist. In my theory, those are the very first two planets that form, and they form first with the sun shedding a ring. Within the disk theory, the sun forms, and then you have a disk, and then somehow planets have to make do out of the disk.
So the disk theory, they should be around the same age.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, in my theory, Neptune is the oldest planet, and beyond Neptune, way out in the boondocks, there's another time, there's a whole stream of objects orbiting out with the Titius Bodleor, way out at about 42 astronomical units. I have a student, Charles Morgan, who's studying that, and the largest of these objects is called Quawar. It's not quite as big as Pluto, but it's on a perfect circular orbit, way up beyond the orbit of Neptune. In fact, it could only have gotten there if it had actually formed from a gas ring. And I think the very first gas ring that was formed was out where Quawar is. And in the early 70s, I predicted that the primitive cloud would have started shedding gas rings way out at 10,000 radii. So, So there was a gas ring out there, and Quawar is the largest of that object. There's a whole stream of them there. And they're probably made of very unusual materials, frozen ices of carbon dioxide and even frozen nitrogen. It's very, very... You're almost getting out to the realm of comets, which are the next sort of station out. The comets are like the end of the line. So I hear at Monash, at Clayton, when you get out near Berwick and Pakenham, then you're really getting out to comet town there.
So one final question. You mentioned the orbits beyond Neptune.
Yeah.
Does that confirm the IAU's stance from about 2 years ago?
Oh, yes.
3 years ago, that Pluto is definitely not a planet.
Yeah, look, the longer we look, it's really unfortunate because, Pluto's held such a good station for so long, discovered by Clyde Tombaugh there at Flagstaff and 1930, and it was hailed as a huge achievement. Nothing had been seen since for 70 years. I think, as I mentioned, Herschel had found Uranus. It was discovered, and at least back in 1781, and then Neptune, I think John Adams had predicted, and Le Verrier, actually, I think, also had a hand in that as well. There's such a gap of time in the 70 years, and then another 70 years, I think in the early 1990s, they started to find tiny little objects way out, very much smaller than Pluto, but beyond Pluto's orbit. I think one was called Smiley and something like that.
They've got UB-13.
Yeah, that's right. They've got proper names now, and they're not as exciting.
Eris
is even larger than Pluto, and then, of course, to be a planet, you really have to be more or less on your own orbit, in a circular orbit preferably. Pluto, unfortunately, suffers various indignities. Firstly, its orbit's highly eccentric. Next, it's inclined by 17 degrees. But the worst part of all, it doesn't even have its own independent period. It goes around the sun twice for every time that Neptune goes around. I think Pluto takes 250 years and Neptune's more or less 170. So Pluto is locked in a resonance with Neptune and not even independent. And it's because of all these features, it's not really, doesn't... So we look on it now as I think we call it either a dwarf planet or a minor planet. Yeah, it's right. And your children would be intrigued by this and probably... understand it more than I haven't been following it as much as I should. But let me say, as we draw towards an end, that I have gotten very excited in this program because I've worked on this problem for many years, and it's over 40 years since Tahar introduced it to me. And I hope to remain active. I'm in my mid-60s now, and my father was fortunate to live to 100, and I almost have as many years in front of me as I have had behind. But of course, I won't be able to sort of wield the hammer as fiercely as I did in the early days. And but nonetheless, I hope to deliver quite a few more savage clouts. And in particular, I think what I really need to do, I've given the chemistry a good run, and now I need to go back to where I was in the 1970s and now rebuild the theory of supersonic turbulence. As I said, it'd be nice if they can find evidence for that. It certainly, I think it's the mechanism that drives it all, but it remains yet to be fully confirmed. I have a student working with me, Yvette, who's looking at this problem as well, and she's trying to model these turbulent columns of gas in the cloud, and Yvette Marcus, and hopefully her work will sort of endorse what Chris Dyte from Perth has done and extend the work. And Chris did a huge achievement, but we only made a small scratch on the big problem. And so those are the problems I intend to look at. I'm really certain that there's no other theory that's come anywhere near as close as what has happened to the modern Laplacian theory, and I took advantage of that golden era of space exploration, which coincided with my commencement of my lectureship here at Monash University in 1972, and I have successfully used that time to build the theory and make predictions. But now I need to sort of consolidate the theory, make sure I pass it on to good hands. And also, I should just add a note of caution that no matter how hard we work, we never see the whole story. Maybe I've seen part of the story, and maybe some of it will survive. I think the elements that will survive almost certainly will be the supersonic turbulence, because the model has achieved far more than it should have. It had been just a random model or a matter of chance. So there's something in there, and as I said, even my worst critics admit there does seem to be a diamond sort of down the mine. And so ultimately, I think we'll narrow it down, and that's how science works. You refine one theory, you find weaknesses in it, and you have to abandon. And I must admit, there have been some unsuccessful components to the theory. You did mention at the very start about Tethys. Well, at the time, I was right. Its mass did fit in with the NASA observations, but of course Cassini now has arrived, and it's got improved observations, and that early prediction really was, it doesn't really hold in light of the new data, but the bulk of the theory has stood up, and that's all you can hope to do. And and I think that's my contribution, and I'm not trying to prove that my theory is correct or it's right, but I am trying to prove is that it is a valuable working hypothesis, and ultimately it may be shown there seems to be no other hypothesis that really comes anywhere near as close. And then eventually younger people like yourself will be able to sort of be in a position maybe to take the matter further, and maybe then the modern Laplacian theory will then become fully established.
Okay, well, Dr. Andrew Prentice, I'd like to thank you very much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
It's been an equal pleasure and a delight that a former student of mine should come back, and we should enjoy such an exchange. Thank you.
And for the listeners out there, if you've enjoyed this discussion, there's actually an Andrew Prentice fan page on Facebook, I believe, set up by some of your students.
Oh, that's an embarrassment. There is a thing called the Andrew Prentice Appreciation Society, which had been set up without my knowledge, and there's literally several hundred students over the years have contributed to that. And I, unfortunately, to keep students alert during class, and particularly since the introduction of fees now and so on, with all the, in the old days, I said it was just chaos and the students had enough self-excitement, but to keep students motivated and also it's tough now. Students have to work part-time jobs, and it really is a completely different world. I want to make their educational experience enjoyable, so I try and make my lectures lively, and students unfortunately have a knack of copying down some of my quips, which I'd much rather forget, and these have found their way onto Facebook. But it's really just a reflection of the fact that I do enjoy teaching, and apparently others have enjoyed it as well.
Well, I've enjoyed our discussion today, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Pratt.
Brains Matter.
And what a great way to end that interview. As Dr. Prentice said, it's all about the science and it's all about the learning. And I've had some feedback. Chris Bowen from Melbourne wrote in and said, that interview with Andrew Prentice was very interesting and made a lot of sense. Well, I hope you enjoyed the final part of that interview series, Chris, and I hope the rest of you did as well. I'll leave you all with a quote from Edith Sitwell. Eccentricity is not, as dull people would have us believe, a form of madness. It is often a kind of innocent pride, and the man of genius and the aristocrat are frequently regarded as eccentrics because genius and aristocrat are entirely unafraid of and uninfluenced by the opinions and vagaries of the crowd. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right-hand side. Comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email. All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now.